Thank you very much. And I want to thank the organizers for the kind invitation, and it's been a great conference. I enjoyed all the talks. The title is Representations, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to call attention to the distinction between representations of something and then something. For example, in groups, you know that group theory is quite distinct from the theory of representations of whatever class you look at. Similarly, the study of C-star algebras is in many ways just as distinct as the study of their representations. And among the C-star algebras, there's one that has some features that are especially good for the kind of applications I'm looking at. But before I forget it and get carried away, I just mention some of my collaborators. Those are the ones who collaborate with me most on this particular project here, but of course I have many other collaborators, and I'm thankful to all of them, but these three here have collaborated with me most directly on this particular project, so that is that. And so now, as I said, you have the object and its representation, and the object in this connection here is the one that's called the Kunz algebra. And it turns out, so it looks so innocent on the top line, and many of the speakers have mentioned it already, so there are many ways to translate the first line into words. For example, a bunch of isometries with mutually orthogonal ranges, and the range projections add up to the identity projection. But you could actually formulate it just as C-star algebra with generators and relations, and take line one to be those relations. But it turned out, and so anyway, it has a long history. Part of the history is perhaps not so well known in mathematical circles, and that is that this way of thinking about a problem or dividing it up in smaller pieces and make sure that the smaller pieces are mutually non-interfering and translating that into the language of Hilbert space in one way or another, that actually goes back to the early days of signal processing, where you divide a signal up to its frequency components and make sure that there's non-interference. And after you have done that, it's done with what's called filters, then it's transmitted over some medium. In the old days, of course, it was a cable. Now it's the same techniques that are used for wireless media, and it's a very basic idea, and I want to call attention to it. I thought that I learned the Kunz algebra first time in the 70s, but it's not true. I learned it when I was in the kindergarten, because my dad built high-pass, low-pass filters. And so these S operators could also parameterize such filters. And I'll get back to that part of it as well. Of course, what Kunz did is motivated by an exercise in Dixmier's book, show that this is a C-star algebra, and it's simple and it's purely infinite, and it has an accessible K-theory, so you can separate separate these algebras and compare them with other C-star algebras. But I already made a promise that there'll be no K-theory, so I'll skip that part of it. But what about the representation? So take your favorite Hilbert space. What you're looking for is that it should be a sum of orthogonal pieces, each piece an isometric copy of the whole. So that means that the Hilbert space must be infinite dimensional. You would only get infinite dimensional representations. So the smaller pieces are just to call attention to them. The distinct pieces, I use separate colors for them. And then you can continue this process. So already this caricature makes it clear that it suggests the use of such representations in the study of self-similar systems. So that will come up. Other applications are wavelets and the use of the representations in computations with wavelets, and in addition to that, the interplay between geometry and spectrum, and represent representing them in Hilbert spaces built as L2 spaces with respect to measures, so you get measure classes. So that was a little bit of the or just the introduction to that. To emphasize again the feature of representations, how if you start with an object, how do you know that it has representations? What about starting with a locally compact group? The reason that you get your hands on representations right away is that there's a Haar measure. So now you look for something like this in this case here, and the moment you get your hands on representations, you always then ask for how they decompose into irreducibles. One of the reasons for the interest in this particular one here is that these ideas of finding parameters for the irreducible representation starting with continuous groups were developed in the first half of this of the last century, and the thing people first looked for is a set of parameters, a Borel classification of the equivalence classes of irreducible representations. So then divided things up in good and bad, and sometimes they're called type one, and then the bad parts are further subdivided. But the bad parts are the ones where you can't do that. And so Glim, in fact, showed that first of all, he made that precise, and with that, you could show that the Kunze algebra is bad. It doesn't allow a Borel classification of the irreducibles the way we say it is, that there's not Borel cross-section for them. Get sort of an analog of what you might be doing with the Haar measure in a group, I want to rephrase the Kunze algebra as a functor from Hilbert space into C-star algebra. So you give me a Hilbert space L, it may be finite dimensional, but the representations would be infinite dimensional. And then I just look for a map that sends L into VL. So L is in the Hilbert space and VL is supposed to be in some algebra. And so let's see what happens. If we insist that it's functorial, then we should also insist that the norm is the same. That means the norm before you do it should be the same as the norm after you. But after you do it, it's a C-star norm. It's an operator norm. They're supposed to be the same. Now, one of the ingredients in the first equation I showed you was this orthogonality relation. And if you just introduce coordinates in an ONB, then that looks like this, which means that when you multiply the elements in the C-star algebra together, you can think of them as as operators, if you like, because every C-star algebra can be embedded into an algebra of operators, we know from Gelfand. Then on the left-hand side, you have an operator. On the right-hand side, you have a number times the identity element or the identity operator, that number being the inner product. Now, take the two vectors L to be the same. Then on the right-hand side, obviously, you have norm squared. And on the left-hand side, you have the norm of, the norm of this one, as we know, is the norm of the squared. So lo and behold, you get that they're the same. Maybe I could just have written it here. So norm VL star VL is the norm VL. Star is the norm of L star. So this is the Hilbert and this is the C star. Did that work? More or less, yeah. Okay. Then maybe we could try to be optimistic and hope that we will get interesting representations by just repeating this idea that led to a bunch of, the duality of thinking about representations. You can think about them as representations or as states, because if you have a state, you can always get a representation by the familiar Gelfand-Neumann-Siegel construction. And so what you could do if you just have your Hilbert space is that you could have a cyclic vector, and then you can take the operator with a star on it, and then almost killing that cyclic vector, taking it into a multiple of itself, and the multiple could be an inner product. that would actually that would generate representation, but for the applications that I have in mind here, it'll be totally useless. So I'll not say a lot about it, but it's sort of the obvious thing that you do if you only have a Hilbert space and nothing else. So it's a little bit, so the most intuitive way of getting representations for the particular applications I have in mind would be useless. So we have to do something else. And what the applications I have in mind have to do with representing these fractal systems, self-similar systems, and they always begin with an endomorphism. And one thing you do have for every representation of these is an endomorphism. And that, in fact, goes both ways, and you can even introduce an equivalence class so that it's a bijection. It's obvious that if you have an SI system, you get an endomorphism, and the going the other way, I think Bill Arvidsson is probably the one who identified that. An endomorphism in B of H has an index. What is the index? Well, the relative commutant of the range of the endomorphism, you can check, is a type 1n factor, and so it's the n by n matrices, so it's generated by the generators for the matrices Eij, and then you fiddle around and you get that the Eijs have this representation here, that gives you the representation of the Kunze algebra. So starting with an endomorphism, you can get a representation, and it's easy to get from a representation to an endomorphism, this being the definition of the endomorphism. And what is key here is that the relative commutant is generated by these elements Si, Sj star, and these elements satisfy the relations that are familiar for the generators of the matrix algebra. In other words, Eij you can represent as the matrix that has a 1 in the ij place and 0 all the other places. So you see exactly that the relative commutant is generated by a system of generators for matrix algebra. And conversely, starting with an endomorphism like this, you can get the representation. And two representations give the same endomorphism if the generators are related by an element in the unitary n by n matrix group. So that was that. But I already mentioned that we want to apply it to systems of self-similarities. And self-similarities have a geometric feature to them, and they have a measure theoretic feature to them. The simplest kind is one that comes from just a bunch of contractive mappings in a complete metric space. That's really all. The kind of fractals and self-similar systems you teach in Analysis 101 fit this description here. The other thing you often wish to do is to assign a probability for each of the pieces of each of the maps that you have here. And then you want a probability measure that preserves these. And that means that if you transform, the measure that you're looking for is one that has the following property. You take the measure, you take the maps tau I, there's a standard way of transforming a measure if you have a map. I guess it's supposed to be a measurable map, but these are obviously continuous, so there's only measurable. And then you add them up with these weights here. It corresponds to doing infinite product measures, as I'll show in 7 slides further down the road. And it has a lot to do with constructions going back to Kakhtani, but this particular one was identified by Hodgkinson in 1981. By introducing a metric on the probability measures on a complete metric space, you can show that the expression on the right-hand side of this equation here as a function of the measure is contractive. And then the Banach-fixed points theorem says that there's a unique fixed point, and that would be one of these measures, mu here. And that's as I said, if you have to make representations of these algebras here, you have to start somewhere with a measure. Somehow you have to get your hands on a measure, and this is a good way to do it. Examples of these would be where you take matrix multiplication on take your integer value, take an int matrix with integer valued entries and multiply and pass to the quotient, and that would be a multivalued map, and therefore it has branches of the inverse, and so that would be an example of how to get these systems here. And so if you have such a system, then you get a measure, and the measure is supported the support of that measure is set where these tau maps act irreducibly. So how do you turn this into something where you can compute? So here's one way to do it. Let your index set be some alphabet. It could be the numbers from 1 up to n, or any way you choose to label the generators for your systems. And so then obviously you get an infinite Cartesian product, and if you put on the Bernoulli measure, it'll be a measure space. And now what you can do is, so that's an infinite word, you can shift it left to right. If you shift it left, you lose one, falls off the table, but that's all right. If you shift it to the right, then you have to say what you want to put in the first place, and you just put in something from your alphabet. So you get two maps, sigma and tau I. The index I there is what you choose to put in on the first place when you shift to the right. And you see that these maps satisfy this. So the tau I's are branches of the inverse of such a map, sigma. So I say that this is a simple symbolic representation of such a system. Now, remember in the previous slide I said that it helps if the tau maps are contractive. Because if the tau maps are contractive, then if you take an infinite word and then keep applying them like this and intersect over n, you see that you get a singleton. So you actually get a mapping from your probability space into whatever fractal you generate this way. And so this is always one way you can build these mappings here. And again, the mapping pi here then respects the maps in the two places, it intertwines the tau I system with the symbolic tau I system. There is not always an analog of sigma for concrete fractal iterated function systems. It depends on whether the pieces overlap or they don't overlap. If there's a sigma, that corresponds to systems with no overlap, and in general the mapping pi can be quite complicated. There could be many points in a particular fractal that are represented by the symbolic representation could be many to one, is what I wanted to say. Maybe I'll just do it this way here. So here it is. Or maybe I don't know if it's a good idea to try this. I'll do it anyway. So I mentioned this Bernoulli system here, an alphabet. What about taking the alphabet to consist of plus minus one? And then take these two mappings, tau plus and tau minus, then take a random variable, which sends an infinite word here into a power series with a variable s here, and then you put pluses and minuses according to what infinite word you have here. That's a random variable on this Bernoulli probability space here, and the distribution of this random variable here is such an iterated function system measure. So examples of these measures include the distribution of random power series here. And if the number s is equal to a half, it'll be the standard Haar measure, the Lebesgue measure on the unit interval. If the scale number s is a third, it'd be the middle Cantor, which I'll be looking at more closely in a moment. If the scale is a fourth, and I only use two shifts here, so then I would have leaving, I'd be leaving out stuff in the middle and getting a fractal, and the distinction between scaling 3 and 4 turned out to be quite significant for the way we understand representations and the role the representations of the Kunz algebra plays in this. So that's one thing I want to call attention to. And and so I'll just go back to the matrix case here, where you have a matrix of a certain size over the integers, and you look at the quotient here, and then these are the transformations, and the example I showed you a minute ago fits into that. It's just that a one-one matrix is just a number, but other than that, these are the transformations, and you get these relations satisfied that we discussed here. And as I said, if you fill in all the gaps here, then you get just the Haar measure on the torus. If you don't fill out everything, you get fractal measures where you leave gaps. Here's one that looks nice in two dimensions, Sierpinski, and this is the middle third Cantor, and this is where you scale by 4 instead of scaling by 3. You can work on the right hand side of the origin, or you can have the point 0 sitting in the middle. That doesn't change anything here, but if you choose these set of parameters, that's what it looks like. All right, so this is what I call a geometric, and by the way, you get representations of the Kunz algebra this way here. It simply is a representation that applies these tau maps here, and I'll show you some formulas for it in a moment. But before I do that, I want to show you another side of these representations. You can go and take your Hilbert space to be the Hardy space that we've already discussed. Almost every one of the previous speakers discussed it, so I don't need to say a lot. Then what you can do is you can take two operators, one substitute z with z squared, and the other one does that and then multiplies by z. You can easily check that's a representation of O2. So it's an element in rep O2H, where H is a Hardy space. What if you substitute the third powers of z instead? And then you just get another representation. These are what we call in my work with Bradley, we call them permutative representations because they permute at basis in the Hilbert space. And the one here with 4, so you'd think that they would be quite analogous. Turns out that they're very, very, very different. The first one here is sort of easy. It just says that you can think of the L2 space and the circle as the Hardy space and the unitary equivalent by the Fourier transform. Then you can try to do the same in 3, and everything breaks down completely, entirely. Those are totally inequivalent representations. The one on the Hardy, or rather subspace on the Hardy space, is totally inequivalent to anything you can build up with these tau transformations. Then you go to 4 here. With the tau transformations, remember I told you that you get an L2 space with this fractal measure mu 4. The Hausdorff dimension of mu 4 is a half. If you know about the fractal, the Hausdorff dimension, you can easily calculate it. If not, just think that a half is really making it different from Lebesgue measure. Lebesgue measure in the line has dimension 1, obviously. And if it has dimension less than 1, you should think of the measure as being thin. Its support is a fractal, and the Lebesgue measure of that fractal is 0, but the mu 4 measure of it is 1. And so the distinction between these two cases with scale 3 and case scale 4, that will come up and haunt us in several occasions in later slides here. And so I'll mention the 4 case now, and then I come back to the 3 case later. It's because the L2 space for this particular mu here has an orthonormal basis which corresponds to the elements in the Hardy space with powers of z, so the constant z. So maybe I'll just do it like this. So z to the 0, z to the 4th, z to the 5th, and z to the 16th. So this is what we call lacunary power series, and obviously it generates a closed subspace of the Hardy space. That closed subspace here is unitarily equivalent to the representation on the fractal, with the tau representation in the fractal. The corresponding thing is completely false for scale with 3, and the significance of that would come out a little later. Before I do it, I just want to help you visualize these things. The fractals here, if we want to think about them as sitting in the Hardy space, then the Hardy space would be a bunch of functions in the circle, and so instead of having the fractal sitting on the interval, then we wind the interval around and then have the fractal sitting going around the interval, and if we put a 2 pi in the exponent here, then we can get the lambdas running through the integers, which it did in the previous case here, and in that case we can choose a period interval with period 1, otherwise you would have period 2 pi, and so your fractals sit like this, and so you can see that they're quite thin here, and the 4 case is illustrated. The 4 case says that the elements in the subspace of the Hardy space have the property that they always split up like this, according to the substitution with z to the 4th. And the multiplication by z, that's exactly what the representation of the Kunze algebra does. And so you can continue that, and you see that the particular subspace of the Hardy space we're looking at has a self-similar feature that you can represent this way here. And the conclusion is this. And as I said, that conclusion is totally false from U3. In my work with Peterson, we showed that you cannot even have more than 2 orthogonal basis elements in L2 of the Cantor measure with the 3 instead of 4. By contrast, you have this. That turns out to have some other consequences. I think actually of relevance to classical problems. So again, the representation of L2 functions. So again, I mean in the 4 case, and I said that by theorem I have with Peterson, we have such an ONB, and the set lambda is this set here, the lacunary power series, And so now if you represent the functions as functions on the circle here, then you know that everything in the Hardy space by Fatou can be represented as L2 on the circle. But if you restrict that representation to this thin Cantor set, remember the thin Cantor set has 0 Lebesgue measure, but mu4 is supported on that. So mu4 applied to that thin set has measure 1. Then what it says is that even though the support of mu4 is very small, it determines this element in the Hardy space as long as you use that measure and not Lebesgue measure. If you use Lebesgue measure, it gives you nothing because the Cantor set has measure 0 with respect to Lebesgue measure. But if you restrict the boundary function and use the fractal measure mu4, then it's an unitary isometric isomorphism of the two Hilbert spaces. And as I said, it's not the case for dividing by 3. So this slide here is a way to summarize what I just said, the two cases that I want to compare, and the two elements in rep 02, the tau representations. Maybe I should take this one here off. It's probably just overkill to have two on. So here we have division by three, division by four, and the 202 representations. And this is the one I said, you multiply modulo the integers. Remember, I set it up so that I have the functions being periodic with period two. And then the two tau maps divide the system up. So you can see that the first system here is divided up in F0 and F1. The second system is similarly divided up in F0 and F1. And then you do these two tau maps and you get representation in L2 of whatever the measure is. And then you compare that with the Hardy space representations, and it's in one case where they're unitarily equivalent, even with the Fourier transform, and in the other case they're totally inequivalent. So one of the things I'll do next is try to make precise how you detect this feature about what can happen with these representations. But before I do it, I want to mention just a couple of more classes of representations. And again, as I said, none of these classes here would fit the functorial one that I mentioned in the beginning, the one that comes from what we call the Kunz states. The top thing here is again the one I remember from a picture I remember from my early childhood. And my dad was building these high-pass, low-pass filters, and lo and behold, that was the picture. I totally forgotten about it until much later, and indeed that is. But it's also the representation. It's also a picture of a representation of the Kunz algebra. That's exactly what it is. So of course they don't care about K-theory and stuff like that. But in order to understand that, then we translate it into mathematics. So a signal is just a sequence of numbers indexed by the integers z here. And so we have to have a dual variable. So in mathematics, we say the dual of the group of the integers is the circle group. And the way we represent them is by generating functions. And the z variable is a frequency. And if we introduce a parameter on the circle, theta here, then you get that the frequency is represented in a period interval, which I can take to be 1, and I can take 0 in the middle. So I have a low frequency and a high frequency. Low frequency is the points close to 0 and the rest. But if I put it up on the circle here, then I would have the low on the right. And if I put it down on the line here, then I will have the low in the bottom of the blue. I guess, I wonder if this has color. Yeah, it has color. So I have the low frequency in the bottom there. And so the filter functions here are the functions which give you the an element in rep 2. So you see, if you do this substitution with z squared, you want to cook up some functions that give you an element in rep 2. And for this particular application, you have to have the functions do what's required for this application, which is that you pass the low frequencies with one filter and kill them with the other filter, and you have a separate filter that does the opposite. And it has to be, well, the easiest case is if you use cosine squared and sine squared, but that's very primitive and not so useful. The other cases are the filter functions that were used in the early days of signal processing. Lo and behold, much later, those filter functions are also the ones that give you the good wavelets, but totally they invented totally independently, and one didn't know about the other and vice versa. Of course, the wavelet people later found out this early presence of these. And so there are many ways of characterizing the M0 and M1, or you could have several bands, in which case there would be a bunch of these M functions. One is that you should look for functions so that if you put them into a matrix like this, in this case a 2x2 matrix, the property of the function you look for is that for every frequency theta, this would give me a unitary 2x2 matrix. So how do you do that? Well, I'll show you in a moment. But before I get to that, I just want to mention again, you can increase the number of variables. This is multivariable, so I should stress that. And the modification in the terminology is very, very minor. Instead of taking z to the squared, you take z raised to a matrix power. How do you do a matrix power? All you have to do is recall that the d tors is just the circle group Cartesian particles have d times, is also the quotient of rd with the d dimensional integer lattice. And so if A is a matrix over the integers, it passes to the quotient, and therefore it makes sense to talk about Z raised to the matrix power. And so that was just that. And I promised to tell you how then to do all the M functions with that piece of technology. So here we go. maybe I'll try to do it this way. So I take any number. In this case here, we could think of n as the number of frequency bands. Take any one, and then take a projection in the n-dimensional complex Hilbert space. Actually, you can take P to be a one rank one projection because if it had higher rank, then you could just take products of more of these. And it's obvious that this 2x2 matrix is a unitary matrix if P is a rank 1 projection, and the product of unitary matrices are unitary matrices, and so you get a function from the circle group into the n by n unitary matrices, and that is step one. What is step two? So this is probably a good one to take over here. Here's step two. So this is a group because UN is a group and you can multiply functions mapping into a group. Since T is a circle group, and then when you map in there, the range is a loop like that, so I call it the loop group, but that's just me. Now, take one of these U's, any one of them, substitute Z to the n, and then apply it to the increasing powers of Z, starting at 0, going up to n minus 1. Obviously, we'd work modulo n. And so a unitary matrix applied to a column vector is a column vector. Then here I put in what's called the Hadamard matrix, HN. It's just the matrix used in finite Fourier transform. It's one that has the powers of the nth root of unity inside it. And the purpose of that is to create these filters that have a low band and the next band and the next band and the highest band. And that is accomplished with such a Hadamard thing here. You multiply this together and you get a column vector. But since Z is a dummy variable running over the circle, then you get a vector function. So we multivariable a vector function here. These functions are precisely the MI functions that give you an element in rep ON on this Hilbert space here. And so this is kind of an easy Hilbert space. There's no fractals in that. However, if you change these low pass, high pass conditions and kind of pass things the wrong places, then all of a sudden, instead of getting L2 of T with respect to Haar measure, you get L2 with respect to one of these fractal measures. And so you get wavelets on whichever one of the Hilbert spaces you design the filters to accommodate. So let me summarize again. The variety of all the functions that would give you these representations are also the functions that are used both in signal processing and in wavelet theory. And they can be cooked up by that easy way here. And I remember I often talk to engineers and explain, I don't say it this way, they have to translate into their lingo, but they're often surprised, no, I thought there was only three wavelets, but now I found a fourth one. Now, how many are there? And the answer I can give in this crowd here is there's an infinite number of them. There's as many as the elements in this infinite dimensional unitary group here. And lo and behold, up to a fairly explicit equivalence relation, every element in this unitary group here gives you an element in rep, and it's irreducible. So go back to what I said about a set of parameters, a Borel cross-section that labels all the irreducible, the equivalence classes of the reducible. That is exactly what this is. But of course, it's not all of them. It's just the ones that give these kind of wavelets, because by Glimm's theorem, you could never get all of them. But it's a class that's very, very relevant for applications, where, as opposed to the one I showed on the first slide, which is very irrelevant for that. All right. Back to multivariable. Now it really becomes multi. So we start out with words of finite length, and the indices I run over a finite alphabet, and let's say that n is the size of the alphabet. So you have two, you have multi-indices like that, and if you have a multi-index, you can put it in on the S's, and you can take the adjoints. And now let's look at some subalgebras that help us in understand representations. You can take S with a multi-index and another one with a star, and have the two finite words of same length. They generate a subalgebra of O(n). It's a popular one in C star theory. It's called UHF, but I won't even say why. It's uniformly hyperfinite, and the reason is that it's an infinite tensor product of n by n matrices, and so you can approximate every element in it arbitrarily well with a finite tensor product of n by n matrices. How do you get them? Well, the I's and the J's were finite words, and you can remember I showed you how to get the E generators from the S generators. So this product here can be sent into a tensor product of E generators, and that is actually the key to the statement I mentioned here, that the subalgebra of O(n) generated by these elements is that C star algebra. It's sometimes called N infinity because it's, and that was also the first algebra Glimm looked at, by the way. But what if you take I equal to J, and in this representation, that just corresponds to the diagonal matrices. Remember, that's how I gave you the E's. So you get a maximal abelian subalgebra there. And so the thing that you should start looking for in understanding the representations is you should look for the Gelfand space of the representation of that maximal abelian subalgebra of O(n) here. And so that's how you always start when you want to get your hands on representations. So let's see, if we were lucky and applied that principle to the wavelet representations, then what we would want is that the corresponding operators here should be diagonalized. It turns out that that's not the case in this form here. So it would be nice if there already were multiplication operators, but they're not. And you can already see here, if you just take SI, SI star, it fails to be a multiplication operator because there's an FZ term, but there's also F at minus Z. And if you have ON for N bigger than 2, then you do the similar formula here with the nth root of unity. So you actually have to really get your hands dirty and diagonalize this abelian algebra here. And so that was that. But right. And so to get us started with the last sprint here, I want to show you how to get your hands on the various components here in a representation. You can ask for decomposing a representation into a sum of irreducibles. You can ask for each irreducible and restrict it to that subalgebra and ask how that decomposes. One of the things I'll be showing you here is that for the permutative representations, that corresponds to a nice graphic representation with finite cycles, and each cycle parameterizes the reducible representations of O(n) in the class of permutative representations, and each dot within a cycle represents how the irreducible each irreducible representation decomposes into reducibles of the subalgebra. And I probably have to cut corners here. Maybe I don't have time to give you all of it, but I mentioned the matrix representation a moment ago. A few years ago, there was a notices article that I wrote explaining this, and on the cover was a picture corresponding to a permutative representation with a 2x2 matrix, 1, 2, minus 2, 1, and it has determinant 5. So if you want something with full Lebesgue measure, then you have to take your residues in a useful position. I took 5 vectors, 0, 0, and then plus minus on the first coordinate and plus minus 2 on the second coordinate. And then lo and behold, I get 4 cycles, 1 of size 6 and 3 of size 1. And so that would be a graphic representation of how these elements in rep O 5 decompose into reducibles. The fractal here, I guess I didn't make a copy of the one from the cover of the notices. I explained that to my children that I was on the cover of the notices, but then they said, "Is that as good as being on the cover of the Rolling Stone?" And that's probably not. Anyway, so fractal here has some interesting properties. It doesn't tile the plane with the obvious lattice, but it does tile the plane with a bigger lattice, the one where you take step size 2 in the y direction. And so, but it illustrates a bunch of other things in tiling theory, and so I thought it was nice. And so again, you can do the same thing with other iterated function systems. The ones with beautiful pictures in the literature are these Julia sets, the simplest of quadratic polynomials, like this one here, and for each value of C here, you have a beautiful picture, and the tau maps are just the two branches of the inverse there, and the measure that I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, by the way, goes under the name the Brolin measure, because there's a Swedish guy who in the 50s found it before it was found in more generality. And as I said, the Julia set can be thought of as the attractor for the tau plus minus maps, or it could be thought of as Julia did, which was the complement of the union of the open sets for which iterations of the map form a normal family in the sense of complex variable theory. Now, in the remaining few minutes, I just want to mention how you construct Hilbert spaces if you don't have measures at all. Now, that Hilbert space would be a Hilbert space of what's called square densities, and the elements in that Hilbert space would be equivalence classes of pairs. A measure on X and an element in L2 with respect to that measure. Two such pairs are said to be equivalent if you find a third measure. You can take, for example, the sum of mu and nu, and this identity holds. So you adjust each of the functions in the two pairs with a rather negative derivative in the square root here, and that turns out to be an equivalence class. They were invented by Cagetani, by Luan Swartz, and probably by others. And Cagetani again used them for the study of infinite product measures, and that in turn led to the study of, well, actually Powers was influenced by that when he invented the Powers factors. So I have to tell you what's the inner product of two elements in this Hilbert space. That would be the inner product of two equivalence classes. You define it the only way you can, and you see that it only depends on a choice of an element in the equivalence class, but it's supposed to be a Hilbert space, so you're supposed to be able to add vectors together, and you do that again by taking a third measure like this and then adjust the functions and add the functions within that L2 lambda Hilbert space. And so in a paper that I cited here, I actually work out all of the details of that. It's a Hilbert space, and as you see here, that once you restrict mu, then you get a copy of L2 of mu. And the Hilbert spaces are used even in the spectral theory of a single self-adjoint operator, because you can take a function on a single self-adjoint operator, apply it to a vector, and then notice that that is a positive functional on phi, and therefore by Ries, it's represented by a measure, and therefore this expression here gives you a cyclic sub-representation in L2 of whatever you measure you got from. So that's what in the theorem that I'm about to run through very, very quickly, that's what I do for that maximal abelian subalgebra that I mentioned. So in other words, you give me a representation of ON on a Hilbert space, and it's subordinated to these systems of maps that we talked about here, and then I give you a universal representation on this Hilbert space of half densities, so that it your arbitrary representation rho sits as a sub-representation of the universal representation. What does the universal representation do? Here's what it does. The universal representation of ON is transforming an equivalence class. An equivalence class is a bunch of pairs, and the pair phi mu is transformed to another pair here, and you can check that it works out, and you can check that it's isometric, you can check that it gives you an element in rep, and that is what I call the universal representation. And now if you take a measure that is similar to these mu measures from the previous slides, then you can define the representation in the L2 space of that measure by transforming the function with sigma, much like I did in all the examples I gave you. And then I can take an isometry that sends L2 of that measure into the half-density Hilbert space Hx. And again, you check that it's an isometry, and you check that it intertwines. In other words, I gave you I gave you a formula for the representations in the L2 mu space, and I gave you a formula for the representations in the half-density space, and they intertwine. And so, lo and behold, you get it this way, a formula for the representation in the L2 mu space, and this one here. And so the W is isometric, and you can check that they really belong to rep ON on these Hilbert spaces here. This, for example, is a formula for the adjoint, and putting it all together, you get it like this. And so it is true that that there is a universal representation that contains every other sub-representation. Going back to the mystery of the difference between the fractal measures with scale 3 and scale 4, I already gave you what mu to use for the scale 4 case. For the scale 3 case, I really don't know what to use there, so it's not always just you just can't get it in an explicit way. We always have a Gelfand space that diagonalizes anything you want, but that doesn't always mean that you can compute it. And so there's a lot of work to do. For example, the middle third Cantor set, if you could find frames on that, then those would be the frames that would be a counterexample to a famous conjecture of Feichinger, which is known to be equivalent to a conjecture of Kadison-Singer. And so such an innocent-looking measure class as the middle third Cantor can have deep consequences. And so I thank you for your attention.